Now, when we're facing what is unfortunately a kind of seemingly realistic possibility of world war, somehow the meaning of being able to do music and to share music is more even more powerful.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a series of extraordinary talks. Talks that provide a new perspective on the one thing we love the most, classical music. World-famous conductor Alan Gilbert and me, German news anchor Michael Pavelitz, are talking about music. For this episode, we go back to the very beginning, Adam and Eve.
It's not the way most people think about relationships these days.
We talk about Gustav Mahler's Second Symphony.
Was that the Mahler alarm?
About the handling of a record player.
Oh, let's try that again. We're professionals.
And it's about ideas for a different kind of experience.
How about not announcing the program at all?
Wonderful.
We are
Alan Gilbert
and Michael Pavelitz, and this is about music
and life.
Let's start.
Okay,
here we are. It's nice to be in this kind of very casual, spontaneous
Absolutely.
Situation with many cameras and makeup.
Alan, you're wrong. It's just us.
Oh, right here. Yeah, so nice
Entre
to see
nous.
You. Entre nous. Okay.
Nobody's here, and I'm glad you're here.
Yeah. No, I like that. It's wonderful to see you.
Yeah.
It's wonderful to be here. And I'm going to reference it because I have to. It was hard for me to sleep last night because
Why?
I finished the Schöpfung, Haydn Creation yeah. performance last night, and I was so buzzed that I couldn't fall asleep, and so I needed this to sort of make me look like, you know, I'm alive again.
So how was the experience, Schöpfung? How did it go?
Well, this is the thing. It's this piece that I think especially today has this kind of naive, optimistic, joyous character, and at times during the rehearsals in the week, we were thinking, what are we doing? You know, not so far from here, mm-hmm. people's lives, and not just a few people, you know, millions of people's lives are being destroyed. And here we are trying to make this optimistic, positive statement, but actually that's what we do. And that's, in a way, that's what I think we're here to talk about, what music can do. It felt like just the thing, just what we needed. And it's so it's so charming the way Haydn depicts the creation. Every instrument has a kind of reference, and he talks about the birds and the whales and the snake and the lion and then the way he depicts light, the creation of light. I mean, it's this genius, genius piece.
I think this still works today.
You know, it's a bit dated the way Haydn represents the happy couple, Adam and Eve. You know,
it's more Adam. It's about Adam. Eve is, I think, she gets a lesser part, isn't
well,
it?
Well, no, she has plenty to sing, but she yeah. what she says is how happy she is to be able to be led by Adam, and he's yeah. her protection, and he's everything. And it's not the way most people think about relationships these days, but at the time, it was, you know, it was sincere, and it didn't feel as kind of weird and creepy as it has at times in the past. Somehow it just we accepted it for what it was last night, and I actually enjoyed the third part when mm-hmm. which depicts the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve, and it sometimes feels a little bit like a letdown because the creative part is so much fun
yeah.
and there's so much going on, and then you're merely in paradise.
Can be a bit boring,
yeah,
maybe.
Apparently, you know, but it's sometimes felt that way. But this last night, I have to say, it felt like actually
peace.
Piece, and there was something very, very moving about it.
Would you say it's descriptive music, but where he tries to describe something, or because it's the...
That's exactly what the creation is. He specifically, I mean, they're you know, there are many, many sophisticated examples, but in, you know, to take a couple that are just easy to describe, like when he's talking about the birds, you know, the flute will do a little, you know, little fluttery bird-like sounds. The roar of the lion is low trombones and bassoons growling. One of the striking moments is this incredible C minor opening and chaos. It's traditional structure in a way, but unusual rhythms, certainly for the time. They're like accents that come off the beat, and suddenly a bassoon that has this kind of rogue arpeggio. It's as if we're in this primordial soup, and there are little stray body parts that are starting to come together, and it's a brilliant description of chaos. And I was talking to some colleagues, it would be very hard today to depict chaos because there's no obvious musical language that is accepted as the norm. So there's no standard to go against, you see what I mean. And so at the time, this was revolutionary because it's traditional 4/4 time music, but with things that just don't quite fit. It didn't quite come together in his depiction of chaos. And then suddenly when they say, Es werde Licht, when it's like, and let there be light, there's this massive, glorious C major outburst. People talk about Haydn is classical and you have to be elegant and quiet, but actually Haydn was really interested in something that is in, for philosophers is called the aesthetics of the sublime, which is the possibility of art to depict powerful natural phenomena. So storms, and that was a big thing at that time to show the power and the might of nature. And so he really wanted his music to show exciting, beyond human power kind of events in nature. So it was not shy music at all. The whole point was to be dramatic and over the top. And so I like an approach to Haydn that is really full-blooded and not too precious. And I think that's really what he was going for. So it's absolutely descriptive music. But, you know, the reason I'm allowing myself to talk so much about it is that it's what's on my mind right now. And it was so exciting. But also kind of the power of music to show us what's going on in our lives. And maybe it's lofty, but these days when we've had limited possibility to do performances live because of the pandemic and because of restrictions on travel and things are canceled. I mean, it's been tough. It's been really hard. We appreciate even more when we can do performances that bring people together. And now when we're facing what is unfortunately a kind of seemingly realistic possibility of world war,
I hope not.
No, I hope not. Also, not. But listen, it's more. It's we think about it more than we did a year ago. Somehow, the meaning of being able to do music and to share music is more even more powerful.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, very connected to the matter at hand. We have Mahler II recordings.
Another Austrian.
Yeah, and you know his music. He famously wanted music to. His symphonies to describe everything, to be a total picture of life in the world. And somehow this symphony, the second symphony that we're playing pretty soon in Hamburg, is often a piece that is brought out for special occasions because when people want to make a powerful musical statement. And have you seen, what performances have you seen of Mahler II?
None.
No.
Yeah, it's true. I'm looking forward to the first one.
You really didn't prepare. Excellent.
No,
oh, well, you're going to love it. I'll tell you. But you've listened to recordings.
Recordings. I've listened to Mahler symphonies, of course. But actually, no, I preferred the fifth or the eighth, ninth.
From recordings?
From recordings and concerts too. And
okay.
I played the fifth, I think, in the orchestra, no, just the usual orchestra, and the first and the fourth, but never the second.
Really?
What is special about this piece? When did you listen to it the first time? Can you remember?
Well, I'm pretty sure the first time I heard it must have been this Mahler cycle that the New York Philharmonic presented in Carnegie Hall. And I think I was 10. I want to get this right. I think I was 10. I may have heard the Fifth Symphony for the first time when I was 8 because my piano teacher bought me a miniature score of mm-hmm. the Fifth Symphony. And I think it was after that that my parents bought me a ticket to this, I think it was a 2-week Mahler cycle that the Philharmonic presented with 3 different conductors in Carnegie Hall. It was Eric Leinsdorf, Pierre Boulez, and James Levine.
Okay.
They split the 9 symphonies, if I'm not mistaken. So that's probably the first time I heard it. But subsequently, I heard it a lot, and I have many powerful memories of hearing the Second Symphony.
And do you remember this first impression you had? I mean, it's a long piece.
It's a really long piece, but I remember I was a little bit probably an odd kid because I was very excited to go to these performances. And Carnegie Hall has boxes in the first and second mm-hmm. tier. And I think I must have been in the second tier. And at the time, now they've changed it, probably for the very reason that I'm about to describe. At the time, there were no reserved seats in the box. Mm-hmm. There were just chairs, and it was first come, first serve. So whoever got to the box first would get to sit in the front of the box. And now they're reserved seats. And even then, I remember the seats were all normal size seats. Now, subsequently, they've added taller stools so the people in the back actually have the possibility to see something over there, people in front of the box. But I would insist that my father get there early. He was playing, so I could be the first to have my ticket mm-hmm. torn, and I would run like the wind to get to my seat so I would have the front seat. And there was one other guy, another young guy, I remember, because he wore jeans, and he also, the two of us would run, so we always had the front 2 seats in our box there. That was a formative experience for me, because I saw all the Mahler symphonies at a young age. And the symphony, frankly, that struck me the most was the Fifth.
Yeah.
At the time, I remember, because I loved the trumpet solo opening, and something about the Fifth really grabbed me.
Impressive beginning. Maybe beginning, we should listen to Mahler. What do you think?
Well, it's such a striking beginning of the second. Yeah, we can. Yeah, absolutely.
You choose. We found these in the archive of the NDR. This is what's left over.
Well, you said that's your favorite, so let's just start with that because it's on top.
Yeah, this is Bruno Walter. And what I like about this recording is that he knew. Yeah, they were friends. Mahler
and Walter.
So I think it's... do you know how to use those? Yeah. I didn't do this for decades. You said you have a record player at home.
Yeah.
So can you lift up there?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
Yeah, here.
I have to. What
is
do we
it
do?
Here?
Is this open? Yeah, it is open. Oh, we lost the beginning there.
Yeah, we should do it again.
Let's try that again. We're professionals. Okay, you deal with this. This is going very well. Was that the Mahler alarm?
Yeah, no.
No, I'll tell you, this beginning is so striking. Because what we didn't hear because somehow the record skipped over to like the second measure is this incredibly dramatic tremolo on this unison. And it's just such a way, it's like you stick your finger into the electric socket and suddenly your hair stands up on end and you're immediately drawn into this. But what's everything up until that wind entrance that we just heard, boom, 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 ba ba, is a kind of setting the mood. And the cellos and basses do this dramatic growl of a, it's like, what is going on? How do you, you know, it's like, who starts a symphony like that? It's not really a, it's not certainly not a melody, but it's a kind of like grab your attention, something serious is going on here.
This is a bit like shock therapy.
Yeah, totally. And so you're in this kind of dark C minor world of austerity and threatening portent, and it really grabs you immediately. And the first movement is a massive statement. It's
what
so
do you think
exciting.
About this recording? Because in from my ears, I'm not an expert, but it's somehow relaxed.
It feels pretty, easygoing in a way. I kind of, you know, I have memories of performances that will never leave me. Probably most notably Leonard Bernstein, who I know took a lot from Bruno Walter's approach to Mahler. I saw him do the first symphony, the second symphony, the third symphony, the fourth symphony. I'm not sure if I ever saw him do the fifth, but I saw him do 7 and 9.
Wow.
So I actually personally was able to experience, you know, the bulk of Mahler with him, and it was unforgettable. It was life and death with him, and I think he felt that he was composing the music as he performed it. So it was so intense, and it was so dramatic, and with
we should
him,
listen.
Did you find it?
Yeah.
Because it was like, is that the Philharmonic? That just here. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. That's pretty great. It's quite slow, but just has this, you feel like it's meaningful somehow. There was a point in Lenny's career when he, you know, he was music director of the Philharmonic, and then he was gone for a while and actually didn't conduct the orchestra for quite some time. And he had a rough period personally in his life, I think in the 70s. He, you know, lots going on with his personal life and his family and his kind of ambivalent relationship with his wife and figuring out who he was in terms of his sexuality. And I mean, he always knew, I'm sure, but sort of coming to terms with the sort of public face of that. And he had a dark period. But then when he came back, he started to conduct a lot in the 80s with the orchestra, and every concert he did was an event, and audiences loved him, and the concerts were magnificent, one after another. Everything he touched seemed to be just golden, and the Mahler symphonies were particularly exciting. He did a Tchaikovsky 6 that was unforgettable. He did Schubert 9. He did many wonderful things, but the Mahlers were very special, and I was in college at the time, and I made trips down from Boston to hear these performances, and I heard the Mahler 2. He did it twice, actually, because the first time was not recorded. And if anything, that was even greater, I think most people agree, than the one that he came back to do for the Deutsche Grammophon recordings. And there was just this electricity in the hall that you rarely feel, you know.
We didn't find this recording in the archive.
It may not be on LP in the archive.
Maybe we had, but it's so expensive.
Oh, today. Really?
Yeah, yeah. We really pay a lot for it.
Oh, really?
Because a few hundred euros.
Oh, no kidding.
For this, yeah.
Okay.
So Mahler himself was a great conductor, and orchestras feared him, I think. This is what I read. What do you know about it? At the Wiener Hofoper, that he was really the guy who had an iron will.
Yeah, and well, that was back in the days when conductors, you know, did have this kind of autocratic 100% authority, and supposedly he was such a perfectionist and such an idealist that he was uncompromising in what he asked for. And I think it, you know, it ate him up inside also, because he...
And is it true that he forbid audience coming late to get into the hall, and that they had to wait the first time? And
I mean,
that must have been you that time.
Yeah, no, but he was so committed to what he thought was the essential vision of what he was doing, that anything that disturbed it was unacceptable. Obviously, a tortured soul himself, had a difficult life. Yeah. But, you know, what's great about the fact that he was a magnificent conductor is that when he wrote things down in the score, it really was both aesthetic and philosophical and musical, mm-hmm. but very practical as well, because he knew what was needed. So, you know, there's some people who say it's obviously not entirely true that Mahler's very easy to conduct, because you just follow the directions in the score and it...
Yeah, there's a lot written in it.
Yeah,
very precisely.
It's just like, if he says take time, you take time. If he says don't take time, you don't mm-hmm. take time. And if he wants a little faster tempo here, or take a breath here, and it's so clearly...
So you don't have to do anything yourself.
Some would say, which is complete nonsense, obviously, because you do have to put your heart and soul into anything you do. But it's obviously composed by someone who really knows what it means to actually perform, which is not the case for every composer.
What's difficult about conducting Mahler?
Well, I mean, I think Mahler's difficult in the way that any music is difficult. You have to inhabit the spirit and the style and have a personal point of view and find the essence of the music. But Mahler certainly presents difficulties in the fact that it is extremely ambitious and complex and has many instruments and large forces and requires the coordination of many people, practically speaking. And it's very folk-based music. A lot of, especially the inner movements, are often Ländler mm-hmm. dances and waltzes, and should have a natural style, and there's a kind of Mahler style that I think, you know, is a thing.
Dark
but also just the timing and the kind of emphasis on certain notes and harmonies, and you can't just play it neutrally, and mm-hmm. you can't just, in fact, play it exactly as written, because there's a kind of natural Viennese lilt and special flair for pulse that is not self-evident. But also just organizing the forces and the length of the pieces, mm-hmm. figuring out the form within your system so that it doesn't feel episodic.
He asked for a 5-minute break, I remember.
Yeah, I've never seen anyone actually do 5 minutes. I mean, 5 minutes in a concert hall is an eternity.
Yeah.
You know, if you sit for 1 minute not doing anything, you think, what is happening here? Yeah. There was a great 2-minute silence after Bernstein finished Mahler 9 in Carnegie Hall with the mm-hmm. Israel Philharmonic. Mm-hmm. 2 minutes is a long time. It feels like 20. You're just sitting there, and no one dared to almost breathe. But that was only 2 minutes. But it really felt like an eternity. So to sit for 5 minutes, I guess he wanted a kind of emotional break mm-hmm. after the first movement to really set it apart from the rest of the symphony. But these days, no one does that. I've seen people have different solutions. I think Seiji Ozawa once sat down on a chair. He had a chair next to his podium, and he sat down in it.
What did he do?
He just sat there.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, that's a little weird. It just didn't feel natural. So usually what people do is they, you know, you might have the chorus and soloists mm-hmm. enter then, so that's kind of a natural break. Maybe the orchestra can retune. And then that kind of is, I think maybe
it's
that's,
crazy that you have
doesn't
to find
follow
something.
The letter yeah. of the yeah. instruction because it's yeah. not really 5 minutes, but I think it follows the spirit yeah. of the instruction, and that's what I do. So you wait a little bit longer than you would normally between movements. But these, you know, these enormous forms that he created, you have to organize it in your mind mm-hmm. so it feels like one structure and not too many little things. I've actually only done the piece one time, one performance of this piece. And it was a very intense performance. It was on the 10th anniversary of 9/11.
That's the recording you played, the brass part?
Yeah, that's a thing on YouTube.
We should listen to it.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. Can you maybe look it up? It's just, I'm very proud of this. This was my brass section at the New York Philharmonic. And it's like a low brass chorale. And it's some of the most beautiful, well, not just brass playing, but just orchestral playing that I know. And that was that performance. That was a live performance. It was one time, and it's just, you can find it on YouTube. We wanted to mark the anniversary of 9/11 with a serious but optimistic note. And mm-hmm. obviously, being in New York, it was particularly important. We invited families of victims. We invited first responders, firefighters, and it was a very, very intense audience. We had, you know, Ban Ki-moon was there, the Secretary General of the UN, and a lot of prominent New Yorkers. But the people who were really important, I think, to perform for were the people who were connected, actually, to the tragedy of 9/11. And this concert was, I think, live broadcast on TVs around the world. And so it was maybe a little bit, I don't know if it was silly of me to do it literally for the first time under those very public and kind of challenging circumstances. But it's a perfect piece for that, in the Mahler too, because it does start serious, and then there is this kind of sense of optimism and the possibility of rebirth, whether or not you're a believer.
We should listen to this because I found it.
They sound amazing. Now, I remember
how
that.
How important is perfection?
Oh, I mean, not at all, but I think everyone should be feeling the same kind of impulse and pulse. Mm-hmm. And I this was the first time and only time I've performed this symphony ever in my life, but it didn't feel like the first time because mm-hmm. I knew how the orchestra played. I'd been to enough performances of it mm-hmm. that somehow it was kind of in my system. I really felt like I knew it. Also, not just knew it, but knew it with the New York Philharmonic. And it was a wonderful cathartic experience, I think, important. The Philharmonic also, you know, I did, just now I said the German Requiem of Brahms recently. That's the piece that the New York Philharmonic played just a week after mm-hmm. 9/11 happened. That's the first piece that they played in New York after. So that was kind of the kind of bookend in New York for that. And that was an important thing. And it's kind of represents what the symphony means to people. It's often brought in for the opening of a new hall or, you know, kind of landmark events because it is uses the whole forces and organ and chorus and soloists and big orchestra, and also the message is kind of darkness to light.
The meaning, that's what I wanted to ask you. Do you think about death or resurrection or this funeral march? Do you have any ideas about it, conducting it, the first movement? Is there a relation? Like, because you can, we started with Haydn, and where you have the birds and the chaos, and you can listen to it. But this is more abstract. This is.
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously connected because it's all part of the kind of liturgy. It's an interesting question because as musicians, we need to inhabit in the fullest possible way the world and the mindset of whatever piece we're performing. And, you know, this is Christian ideology. I'm not a believer myself. I've never been a religious person.
And Mahler was Jewish then?
And Mahler was Jewish. And, you know, I'm an American musician, but I perform a lot of German music. And I think that it is possible to have affinity and empathy with a lot of different musical cultures and styles, and also philosophical points of view. I think that's the point. It's a little bit like being an actor. I mean, you don't have to, you know, be an abusive husband to portray Otello, for example, or you don't have to be a bad person to portray Iago. I'm just taking a Shakespearean example, or you don't have to be a teenager to play Romeo and Juliet, or, you know, there are obviously thousands of examples. That's the point of acting and being a musician. And
so acting, there's a parallel acting?
I think so, because, you know, when I'm performing the creation, I'm reveling in this idea that actually there was a being or a force that actually created whales. You know, I can somehow not identify with it, but I can believe it. And then when we go to the Garden of Eden, I can feel, this is what paradise is. And Haydn brings in a third flute for that. There's a special sound. It's two flutes for the whole piece, except for this one little number. Suddenly there are three flutes, and the sound of three flutes together is very identifiable and noticeable, but actually that's a musical representation of this very special place that we suddenly are. And I kind of feel, we're actually there. Mm-hmm. Or I try to at least really believe it.
And do you have a feeling, you follow the feeling, or you think you try to give this feeling to the orchestra, or is...
Absolutely, and that's, I mean, it's elusive what transmits as a conductor, what it is, but feeling it fully inside. I mean, I'm not thinking about, you know, my skepticism or my lack of belief when I do this piece. You're fully there. And if you saw Leonard Bernstein conducting the end of this Resurrection, you know, he's completely there. You know, he's like, there's a kind of religious ecstasy that he seems to embody. You know, he was not a believer. And it's I think for any performer, it's possible to really get into it and identify with the impulse that led to the creation of the work. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mahler himself was so pleased or so surprised in a way with what he accomplished with this ending that he somehow thought it's almost as if some other force created the work and he was swept away by it. It's almost as if it wasn't his personal agency that led to it. So in a way, we can all sort of get into it. It's very interesting. I mean, you're a musician. What are you practicing now? What are the pieces you're working on now?
I'm still working on a trio. We'll have a concert with the cellist and the pianist.
What pieces?
It's Camille Saint-Saëns, second trio. It's somehow related to Mahler too. Actually, we wanted to do this piece in December 16th, the day Saint-Saëns died, at the hour Saint-Saëns died, 100 years ago. But then Corona, we had to cancel the concert. And we wanted to do a kind of seance, so dark black box, some candles, and do a kind of meditation before, and video installation, and that's the idea. And then play the piece.
That's very advanced.
The idea was to bring the audience in a mood. And the idea of meditation is to bring them into contact with themselves, to listen inside themselves first, to listen to the inner voice, where am I right now? And I don't know what's going to happen in this kind of experiment.
No, but
to play the music after
should we
it?
Be doing that kind of experiment in the Elbphilharmonie?
Yeah.
We should do that.
Yeah.
Will you help us out?
Sure.
I'd love to do that kind of thing.
Things like that, I think, would be fantastic. It maybe not a whole meditation because too many people, but...
But why? Why not? Do you think people would find it weird? I mean, I love that idea.
But it's good. If people find that weird, then we are back at that times where people went in the opera or concert and they didn't know what's going to happen. This attitude, this approach, I love that. I never read about a film when I go into a movie in a cinema. And I don't know if this is a comedy or a splatter movie or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think this is the perfect mood and refers to compositions when they were played in the 18th century.
Yeah. How about not announcing the program at all?
Wonderful.
It's hard. The marketing people always want to be able to sell it, but I love that idea. And it's also difficult to break out of. There's so many things that are in place that make it hard to be spontaneous, because the orchestra wants to know what they're going to play, and they want to practice, which is reasonable, and the marketing people want to be able to advertise.
Where do you have your spaces where you can try something new?
You know, it's surprisingly difficult to get, like, big institutions like the Elbphilharmonie Orchestra. And this is not a criticism. This is just a sort of a reality check. Because there's so many modes that are taken for granted. So many assumptions about the way things must be. And there's a good side to that, because, you know, if it were possible just to completely throw out the rule book and do anything you want, it could be difficult, or it could, in the wrong hands, could be abusive. And a lot of the things that the structures that are in place are responses to the fact that probably it was possible to do anything. It's like, oh, I don't want to do this piece, let's change it, or you can't play, leave, that kind of thing, you know, in an extreme example. But it would be nice to create a kind of free zone in which everyone was willing to try something new. You know, the orchestra is very, very willing, when they feel the idea is worthy, to try new things. You know, it's been a while now, but a reading of contemporary music is part of our biennial. And it's difficult because these are new pieces, and, you know, these are professional musicians, and they want to prepare no matter what. So even if it's just a reading, they take it very seriously. And then there was a question about whether there should be an audience for this reading, and they thought, well, if we're reading, maybe we don't want to. And I said, you know what, don't worry about it. It is what it is, and everyone understands that it's a reading. No one's going to make any judgments about the orchestra, and it's really educational and beneficial for people to be able to hear it. And so finally people were allowed into the hall. But that's a question. You can see there's this kind of reflexive need to protect yourself, which I totally respect. But this idea of going against what the audience expects, like if they're put into a place that some people might find uncomfortable, or maybe they will love it. Yeah. And maybe they'll say, oh, this is, you know, put me in a new space. We won't know unless we try it.
Yeah,
for example.
But you have to be ready to fail.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's hard to convince some people that that's artistically worthy, because everything's supposed to be perfect, and we're professionals. And I actually think it can be fascinating for the audience to have insight into the process that leads to what we do, and not just, you know, perfectly formed structures.
Though you will lose some listeners.
I wonder, yeah. Probably not as much as people fear. Yeah. We all talk about reinventing the orchestra.
Yeah. Well, if you do a meditation in the Elbphilharmonie, I will definitely come.
Yeah, but it's not just that. It's a deeper, more philosophical question about who we are and what we do. That really should be. That would be a nice topic for another conversation. Yeah.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, no, it's such a pleasure. Really fun.
Thank you for watching and listening. This is About Music, and this is about to go on. So watch out for the next episode.